All right, let's call this meeting of the House Health and Social Service to order. It is 3:05 p.m. on March 27th, 2014. Present is Representative Keller, Representative Tarr, Representative Reinbold, and myself, Representative Higgins. Let the record reflect that we do have a quorum. Our House recording secretary is Butch Carver. Our LIO moderator is, who is our LIO?
Sam Greeley.
And our committee aide is Julie Morris. So if anybody needs any help, just raise your hand. Julie will give you a hand. We'll do the best we can. A little housekeeping is, let's turn off our cell phones. If they ring, it's late in the afternoon, and I always enjoy donuts, especially in the afternoon. So with that, under previously heard bills, we have Senate Bill 169, establishing the Department of Health and Social Services, a statewide immunization program, and the State Vaccine Assessment Council. So may I have a motion to bring CS SB 169 before the committee?
Chair Higgins, I move finance CS SB 169 version 1219 India before the committee for discussion.
All right. Hearing no objections, CSB 169 is before the committee. Come forward. And who would we like? Who are we bringing forward first? David?
Yes.
David? Don't be squeamish, David. And so bringing people a little bit up to speed on the committee, we've heard this bill once before, and now we're going to delve into it a little bit deeper. And I believe if you put your name on record for us, David, and what's your affiliation, and we'll go from there.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm David Teal, Director of Legislative Finance. And the sponsor asked me to come in and explain the fiscal note. I'm looking at fiscal note 6 and 7 in particular, since I think that's where the confusion lies. And I'll give you a second to get 6 and 7 in front of you, and it's probably easier to look at them both at the same time because it's the numbers are the same.
Well, actually, fiscal note 6 is different than 7.
Yes. One, fiscal note 6 is the fund capitalization, and fiscal note 7 is for epidemiology. And this is where the money starts kind of going through the wash machine. And I think it's that wash machine that needs to be explained. So if you look at fiscal note 7, epidemiology, you'll see in the column labeled what's included in the governor's 15 budget. Roughly $4.5 million. And you can look below and see that that is general funds. And you can also see in the first column there, the FY15 appropriation requested, it's negative $4.5 million. So you are taking $4.5 million away from epidemiology, and then look at fiscal note 6, that same $4.5 million is put into the new fund, the vaccine assessment account. So there is no new general funds being spent here at all. It's just being taken away from the division and put into the fund. The purpose of the fund, the money in the division, is pretty much the same, buying vaccines. But now this creates a more permanent program, and they're taking the money from the division, putting it in the fund. Now you can turn back to what the fund, or how the fund uses that money, and you'll see there's an additional in fiscal note 6, almost $27 million of general fund program receipts. That's because they take the $4.5 million of general funds, remove from epidemiology, put into the fund, they use it to buy vaccines. As that vaccine is distributed to providers and presumably used, there's a fee assessed. That assessment is general fund program receipts and comes back into the fund, where it buys more vaccine and goes through the cycle again. So There's no general funds added here. It's strictly that, essentially, you're buying vaccines, using the money from selling them or getting your fee assessment to buy more. If you don't get the general fund program receipts, then the fund won't be replenished and they can't buy vaccine, more vaccines. So I think my problem with the fiscal note, my question with the fiscal note was, is the $31 million that you show going into the fund sufficient? How many rounds will that $4.5 million make? Because you don't want to be in a position to under-authorize the number of times that money turns over. And the department said they felt comfortable that they won't exceed that $31 million. So basically, it's a net zero fiscal note from the GF's perspective because you're simply moving money from one place to another and buying and, or I should say, almost selling. I think you're providing, would you call it selling?
I would answer that now.
Make sure you put your name on the record for us.
For the record, my name is Jill Lewis. I'm Deputy Director for the Division of Public Health. So to answer Mr. Teal's question, the vaccine is not sold or resold. The assessments are done prospectively based on the projected estimated cost of what we will need to purchase for the year. There are assessments throughout the year and payments made throughout the year that generates enough revenue over the course of the year that there is enough money coming in to keep pace with what is going out. The program buys vaccine every month, which helps to manage the expiration dates and the volume needed and respond to whatever disease outbreaks might be going on in the state or whatever the demand is, and that's that we would continue to follow that practice. The reason that the $4.5 million is enough to capitalize us up front, there's several reasons for that. One is that 50% of the children's vaccine is purchased off of a federal grant, which is not reflected here because that money is actually held by the federal government. They don't actually appropriate that money to us. It's a grant that we order the vaccine from them and we spend it down, but it doesn't actually come into the state's coffers. So that grant isn't shown here, but that's 50% of what the children need. Another reason that this will be enough capital to get us started is that we will not have bare shelves on the first day of this program. We've been operating similar for 30 some years, so we have vaccine on our shelves. We also have providers who will have vaccines on their shelves, and they will need to use up that inventory as well. So this is enough capital, we feel, to get ourselves started in the cycle of purchasing the vaccine monthly. Gives us enough time to generate the initial assessments, receive those initial payments, and then to just continue to repeat that cycle as we go. And this has worked well in other states that have done it this way.
Any questions? Well, and from what I've looked into this, you know, just a little bit, now, and from my understanding from the other states that are working with this, it's working pretty good. And it's working pretty good because they're only working with the pediatric side of it, not the adult side of it, of this bill, which I think everyone agrees is doing fine. So this bill is a little bit different on the fact that it does create the adult vaccines into it, which, we still need to work through. And your assessment value, you have not determined that yet, right? To the insurers.
To the chair, if I understand your question, have we determined what the amount of the assessment will be?
Correct.
Per covered life or per dosage? No, we have not. It is in the range of anywhere from $50 to $200 per person in the other states. There's a lot of variables that go into that, including what their vaccination rates might be, what kind of vaccines they recommend and include, and what prices they're able to leverage. So it's difficult for us to say at this time exactly what it would be, but it would be in that order.
And getting back to the assessment formula, what now I know that you've got a letter of support from Premera that I've seen, I believe, somewhere in our package. How many other letters of support have you got from the insurances?
Mr. Chairman, I don't believe we've gotten any other letters of support that the sponsor has received specifically from other health coverage type of entities. The Medicaid program plans to participate. They are health coverage and are part of this bill. That is a significant portion of the population.
Isn't that an important cog in this whole wheel, is the support from the insurance industry on paying the assessment? So should we not have letters of intent of, yeah, we do support this and we will follow through with our commitment?
Mr. Chairman, we have certainly had conversations with some of the employer-based plans. The Human Resource Directors Group has been talking to our Chief Medical Officer, Dr. Ward Hurlburt. I believe he's online. He can speak a little bit more to those particular conversations about their willingness to participate in the program and what they see as the benefits. I would say that the one other thing is that the Premera, which is the letter that is in your packet, has 75% of the private healthcare market in Alaska.
Yeah. Well, those are basically the only questions I had as far as that, you know, going, because I've already gone down this road and have heard that. And as far as the fiscal note was going, you know, when we had $26 million, almost $27 million here, and you look at that as a fiscal note, and I know that everyone says, well, this is kind of smoke and mirrors. It's not really $27 million, because we have $4.5 million, and we're putting $4.5 million in, and we're going to turn that over, and we're going to keep turning it over until we get everyone vaccinated, you know. And so that's where I think all the confusion is coming from. When people look at this and go, well, no, the fiscal note is actually $27 million, not $4.5 million. And so for some – and this is not a finance – you're going to go through this argument with the finance, not through us. Our job is basically to make sure that we've got a bill that's been vetted properly. And when it heads over to that committee, we've done pretty much 90% of the work as far as that goes. But we've had some questions on that. So I appreciate David coming in and explaining that. Are there any questions from the committee?
Thanks.
Nope. Thank you.
Thank you.
Now, if the sponsor wants to come up and talk a little bit more about it before we go to public testimony, we are more than happy. No?
For the record, I'm Jane Conway, staff to Senator Giesel. In conversations with the chairman, I thought it might be a good idea that we kind of walk through the bill, particularly Section 1, which is the nuts and bolts that will paint the picture of how the program should work. So we are going to do that, and also I would like to refer to for the members, this particular document that has the blue ovals on it, it's in your packet, gives a really good basic picture, pictorial, of how each step will go, and that might help a little bit as we go along. All right, so Section 1. establishes a statewide immunization program, sets requirements for vaccine assessments, reporting, and penalties for assessable entities and other program participants, creates a vaccine assessment account. So, Article 1A. A, establishes the program. B, and I think you have the sectional in your packet, by the way. You should.
And can we interrupt you as you're going, or do you want us to field questions in the end? It's up to you.
I think the best way is to interrupt us as we go along, because it's real-time questions then.
And I would agree. And one of the questions I've got as far as the assessment council, who is going to run that council? Is it us? Is it the state? I mean, I know you've got the members that you've picked for the council.
Through the chair, I think that if you go to page 2, line 19, it talks about the makeup of the council. And that the would be headed by the commissioner, of the chief medical officer of the Department of Health. So if you go down to 24, the council consists of 8 members appointed by the commissioner as follows: the department's chief medical officer for public health, also 2 health care providers licensed in the state, 3 members representing health care insurers licensed in the state, one of whom must be a healthcare plan administrator. Each insurer must represent a different organization in the state, a representative of tribal or public health insurance plan, the director of the division of insurance or the designee. Those are the members of the committee, the council, excuse me.
And kind of the reason I bring that up is because I called a few of the states that have this, and talking with them, and the latest one was Vermont, which actually has an adult portion in their bill, which is, for your information, is doing kind of okay. They're still working out the nuts and bolts of it, even though they've been at it for a few years. The interesting part is that they've given up they're having another company run it for them, because it got so kind of convoluted with insurance companies and whatnot that it was just easier for them to do that. And I was just curious on whether you looked into that at all.
Mr. Chairman, for the record again, this is Jill Lewis, Deputy Director with the Division of Public Health. If you see on page 3, line 8, there's one sentence that says, the department shall provide staff and other assistance to the council. What is done in 7 of the 9 states that have similar programs is they contract with a company who has a lot of experience in administering exactly this type of a program. Those costs do not come to the state. Those costs are a surcharge that is part of the assessment and part of the program receipt, so there's no state general funds being used to support the program. We estimate that it's about 1%. It's about 1%, maybe $300,000 a year.
It's $50,000 a year, 3% the first year, 2% the second year, and 1% the third year for vaccines. Overall cost is what they charge. So that's their fee.
Okay.
So you know.
Vermont. Okay.
Which is not bad. It's just that's what they do.
Okay, we're going to then continue on to section 1809-210F1, the plan of operation. Must include the method for calculating the assessment amount for each covered individual, the method for determining proportional costs to assessable entities and participants, procedures for the collection and deposit of assessment fees, procedures for collecting data, which include a minimum number of covered individuals and vaccine usage, and a system for crediting overpayments. Anything in that's a lot of things that need to be mapped out in the plan of operation. Is there some question in that area?
Any questions?
Nope.
Okay.
Looking good.
1809220 requires the assessable entities, participants, to pay the assessment to the department for each covered individual, provide information about the number of covered individuals and actual usage, and also provide audited financial statements upon request from the department. Bookkeeping.
Yep.
Section 1809220B requires that the assessment includes reasonable costs for overhead. The provider's fee for administration of the vaccine is excluded from the assessment. 1809220C states that an assessment is a medical expense for the assessable entity slash participant. 1809.22D provides for a process to appeal the assessment determination to the commissioner. 1809.225 allows healthcare providers to opt into the program to purchase vaccine. 1809.230 creates a special account in the general fund for the assessment fees for the purpose of purchasing vaccines. And appropriations by the legislature will not lapse. And David Teal spoke about that vaccine account.
I'm going to go back to, sir.
Representative Keller?
Yeah, through the chair, back to 225. What? I'm just helping understand, why would somebody not be approved to be part of that provider that applied to be part of it? Do you know?
Through the chair to Representative Keller, there, the only instance that comes to mind would be in a very rare instance where perhaps a provider is not actually already enrolled with the immunization program to receive vaccines and hasn't done their paperwork yet, so they would, you know, be denied at that point, and we would work with them to get their paperwork so that then they could be in.
And 1809240 allows the commissioner to determine a monetary penalty for non-compliance with the assessments.
Well, what do we mean by that?
Mr. Chairman, if an entity refused to pay or did not pay or was paying late, then the commissioner may assess a penalty on top of the assessment. Okay. Not required to.
From my understanding, I think you had told me that the assessment will be done in quarterly payments. Is that correct? I mean, I know we're just talking here. It may be different, but
to the chair, that's what we're looking at doing right now. That's done commonly in the other states. Some states, they have had requests to do it more frequently and to do it monthly, which is a possibility. I think that it has a lot to do with what kind of cash flow in terms of the payments, what it will, how it will work best for the payers and any providers who opt in.
Okay. I would just think that if we had them pay their quarterly assessment up front, then they would be good for that quarter. And then the following quarter, they would have to pay before they would be part of the program. So there's no way there would be a penalty as long as they paid up front like that.
Just Mr. Chairman,
my opinion.
That is correct.
Okay.
All right, we're going on to Section 2, 1809-900. Defines the terms assessable entity, commissioner, council, covered individual, other program participants, program, provider, recommended vaccine, and vaccine. And that is on section 2, and that's towards the, that's on page 5, and that is where the definition section is. Section 3 requires accessible entities to provide information to the department under AS2109-242. Section 4 adds the vaccine assessment account to the list of special accounts for program receipts. I looked in there today. There's actually 86 special accounts under that provision. And this adds the vaccine assessment account to it. Section 5 repeals Chapter 24, SLA 2012, which is actually Senator Giesel's bill that provided the temporary funding. That program will be repealed and replaced with this program. Section 6 redirects the remaining funds from that program to be deposited to the vaccine account. That was somewhere in the neighborhood of $4.5 million. And this makes the effective date July 1st, 2014. That is the end of the sectional analysis. Are there any more questions?
Any questions?
Nope. Nope. No questions at this time. We'll go to public testimony. All right, we'll go to online. Dr. Ward Hilbert, are you on?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Thank you. For the record, my name is Ward Hilbert, and I'm the Chief Medical Officer for the Department of Health and Social Services. Thank you for the opportunity to testify. Again, I apologize that I need to be on the phone due to my wife's surgery earlier this week. You heard on Tuesday from Senator Giesel and Dr. Singleton and others, and I understand that the value of immunizations to our society and Alaskans and the miracle that this really is not an issue, and I won't dwell on that. About 5 years ago, Alaska was number 49 among the states in terms of our immunization rates for 2 years old, and with the $4.5 million of vaccine money for the uninsured, underinsured, initiated by Senator Giesel in 2012 and sponsored by Representative Herron in the House, along with the $700,000 in the governor's base budget, we've improved to number 37 or number 38 among the states in terms of two-year-old immunization rates. That's not good, but it's significantly better than it was. I think that's important to show that with the beginnings of what program will be, we have been able to improve and would intend to continue to do so. The nine other states, as you stated, have developed a program comparable to the one proposed here, and the staffs from the other states have been helpful, and we feel that we have picked the best of the programs and the learnings. New Hampshire has been doing this for more than a decade now. Primera chairs the Vaccine Advisory Commission, Washington State, and they've been very gracious and very helpful in sharing their experience with us. And while we don't have, you don't have in your packet letters from other insurers, really, essentially all of the insurers in Alaska are also in that in Washington State, and they all have participated in the Vaccine Advisory Council there. New Hampshire, which I mentioned and has had the program for a decade, have improved their two-year-old immunization rates, and they're now second only to Hawaii in that. We do have the flexibility, as you know, only Vermont has tried for adults, and we have the flexibility to do that. Our approach has been to try to do what you might say is the, quote, right thing to do, and that would be providing immunizations for all Alaskans, meaning the immunizations recommended by American Committee on Immunization Practices that sets the standards for CDC and for the country. But we also absolutely understand that we can't place the state at financial risk for more general funds for the program, and that the $4.5 million will end at the end of fiscal 2015 there. And so the insurers and the TPA vendors will also need to be assured that they will not be at risk of double payment or paying a higher cost than they have now, and in fact will save money. You have the flexibility under the proposed legislation to prioritize. For example, if there are sufficient funds available, and if the payers, the insurance companies, the TPAs, the vendors, the Medicaid, whoever is paying in, if they're saving money over what they're paying now, and the surcharge covers the administrative costs, and there's sufficient money for the uninsured and underinsured, we would like to do all the recommendations of vaccines for all Alaskans. But kids will have priority over adults. Among the kids, measles, mumps, rubella, that Senator Giesel mentioned on Tuesday, will have priority, for example, over Menactra, which is the meningitis vaccine that you give to kids going off to college. And that's because, one, kids will have priority. Two, we will look at the return on investment. Some vaccines, like measles vaccines, are incredibly a good investment. Others, like the HPV or the Menactra vaccine, are fairly expensive for the benefits that you get. So we will prioritize, just as we do now, with what we purchase. The state will continue to purchase vaccine at rates available to them for kids. It's clear through the U.S. code that we can purchase off the federal schedule, which is very favorable to us. It's not as specific on adults, and if we are not able to purchase for adults there, and adults participate, there are multi-state purchasing cooperatives where we can obtain favorable funding for that group. Other states do include the ERISA employers, which, as you know, the state under the federal protection for those employer plans, the state doesn't regulate them through their departments or divisions of insurance, but the states are legally able to have them participate with the assessment. And as Jill noted, this has been discussed with a group of HR directors from a number of the larger employers in the state, and that this will be a favorable thing. Well, you talked about the administrative surcharge already. We do intend to try to keep that as low as possible, and we would see a success on the first year as trying to get it below that 3% rate, which has been common. But long-term, the 1% is what we would plan on. As a state, we cannot mandate participation by federal programs or by the tribal health system, but there have been discussions with those entities, and they will, to some extent, need to make their own assessment regarding their level of participation. For example, tribal programs can purchase now under the federal schedule, but there would be some advantages. YKHC spends about $500,000 a year on vaccines, and they provide care for non-tribal folks there in the area where they have their service. TRICARE, as has been noted, has been an issue, and that's a Washington, D.C., determined policy that they want to pay after the fact, to pay retail to providers, and that's been an issue in states like Idaho and Rhode Island. I have talked with the CEO for United Healthcare, the largest insurer in the country, their CEO for the Northwest for their government programs, where TRICARE is located, and also their director in Alaska here, as well as the actually just departed commander of the medical group at JBEAR, and they were all willing to work with us to approach their folks in Washington because they see the advantages in saving money and getting better immunization rates. Whether that could change or not, I don't know. Idaho, as you may have seen or heard, did put some general fund money into providing immunization for kids who are TRICARE beneficiaries in southwest Idaho around Mountain Home Air Force Base. Absolutely, clearly, totally, there is no intent to request that in Alaska. That was a decision that state made on their own. In the other 49 states, as far as those that are most successful, not a new mandate for people to immunize here. It's providing it. It's encouraging it. The mandates will not change. But in the other states, those states that have a program like this are about 60% more likely in the best performing states in terms of immunization rates and protecting the population compared to states that don't have a program like this. There is strong support in the state. You have letters from the Alaska Chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics, Alaska Primary Care Association, Primera, Alaska Nurses Association, and so on. One recent letter from a family medicine doc noted that she had reluctantly had to stop giving vaccines because of the hassles of maintaining two sources of, or more sources of supply, two areas of storage, two record-keeping things, and saw this as something that would enable her to again provide immunizations for her patient. The Vaccine Assessment Council will be composed, as was described, of both representatives of providers and payers. And most of the operational details for procuring, storing, and distributing vaccines will be no change from what we've done for many, many years. The administration of the program will be contracted, as you've heard. And the involvement of the private sector will really be much stronger than at any time we've had with the Vaccine Assessment Council. There will be no additional state employees. It really will be a private-public partnership that we've not had in the past. Let me quit with that, Chairman. I'll be happy to try to respond to any questions.
Well, Representative Reinbold had a question.
Thank you, Chair Higgins. Okay, basically what my question is, I'm assuming that the goal of this whole bill is to increase access and decrease costs. And what I'm trying to figure out is, first of all, my first question is, which adult vaccines do you anticipate being the most costly or keeping on hand the most? And if you could just list basically some of the adult vaccinations that you're considering.
Yes, Representative Reinhold. The most cost-effective adult vaccines would be the flu vaccine, which is given every year, and the pneumococcal vaccine to prevent pneumonia, which is given one time. Those, the return on investment, those are the most cost-effective. Tuesday, we all heard Representative Nagyak's comment about the shingles. Shingles is a much more expensive vaccine. It's about 50% effective. Right now, are able to buy that for the uninsured and the underinsured, and we would want to continue to do that. It's not 100% effective, depending on your age. And it's not recommended until you're 60, but it's 50% or maybe a little better effective. But if you had shingles, like Representative Nagyak mentioned, you would take that 50%. But if the money is short, in fact, the protection, the savings of lives, the savings of dollars is better for flu and pneumococcal than it is for shingles, so we would reluctantly give that up. But in order to live within budget, that would be the kind of a priority choice that would be made.
Follow up.
Okay. So basically, there's been so many changes with health care, with the Affordable Care Act, and there's been so many amendments and changes that it's hard to keep up with. But my understanding is, I had hearings about this all summer, but my understanding is that we have to have plans now that cover vaccinations as adults. And I'm trying to figure out, where is the cost saving? If there's a plan that already covers this, where's the state going to save money? Is it the federal government that's going to save money? Is it the patient? Is it the insurance company? Just point out who is going to save money with this program.
Right. Well, with the Affordability Care Act, and I guess I would probably concur with the sense of what you're saying of the way it stands today, it might be different. But it does require the provision of vaccines. Not everybody is going to be insured there, and there is the premium that's paid. Now, we read that there's a lot of federal subsidy. It's still federal tax dollars that are coming to Alaskans that insure, but they will insure through one of the insurance companies that are providing it, one of the private insurance companies, or the Medicaid eligibility has been expanded there. So those vaccines are currently purchased at retail. That cost goes into what the premium is for the private insurance. And we've all read that with what's happening now and the apparent attraction of a more morbid, a more sick population to the plans under the Affordability Care Act, that we may see significant increases in premiums next year. So if we can get the vaccines at a lower cost, it will help mitigate those increases in premiums. For those who come on Medicaid, under the tribal members and the tribal health system, it's all federal dollars, which we're concerned about too, but for others it's a 50% match, and if we can reduce the cost that Medicaid has to pay, half of that's being paid by the state money. So even those who have the added coverage will get it. It will reduce the risk or the demand. There will be less people if that scenario plays out as the federal administration hopes, less people without coverage, but still a lot that will probably have it, particularly those with, quote, underinsurance, if they have it, will be less common because they will be mandated to have the
Want to follow up?
Yeah, I guess I just want to I don't want to put words in your mouth, and that's why I'd rather ask a clarifying question. First of all, the federal dollars, that's kind of somebody's, you know, it's coming, that's someone's tax dollars. Someone's paying for someone else to get covered. Not to be too cynical, but you know, these federal dollars are coming out of someone's pocket. So it is a form of redistribution, but that's really not where I was going with this. Where I was asking you, is the state going to save money? Is the private sector going to save money? Are insurance companies going to save money? I mean, if you could just, in a nutshell, just tell me who's going to win here, that would be helpful.
Through the chair, Representative Reinbold, yes. If the costs of the services that are provided, specifically immunizations, cost less to the companies that have the Affordability Care Act coverage, that will help hold the premiums down, save money to the premium payers out of pocket because the premiums won't have to go up as much. It will save the Medicaid dollars for the taxes that we pay in Alaska. And we'll save, I would go beyond what you say on the federal dollars, it'll save the printing press dollars.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Keller?
Yeah. Hello, Dr. Hurlburt. I trust your wife is recovering. Good to hear you. I really like the aspect of the fact that the providers are very much engaged in this, and you know, and providing really the size of the fund. And that, I guess, what I, as I was sitting here reflecting on the whole process, the size of the fund is the definer of how many immunization services we can offer. And if that we feed it in initially, and then the providers kick in later, as I understand it, based on the assessments, I guess what my question really is, what happens if the wholesale price savings diminishes? What if the price changes? Whatever, as I understand it, that just will make a higher assessment for the providers at this point, and of course, until some point, what they may, of course, anytime come back to us for another infusion of GF. But this just builds a system that that fluctuates, you know, with the market, you know, the demand and the supply, you know, maybe new diseases, new vaccines, all that kind of thing, that is all covered by this commission and council making these recommendations. And the current makeup, you know, yourself and the Commissioner of Health and Social Services, you know, fantastic. I trust you and know you and that. But at some point, I suppose, the council could get make some bad choices, but again, those kind of choices, if it were bad choices, that would be again covered by the assessments that go out. The cost assessments that go out by the council. Am I understanding it? I'm just kind of testing my understanding.
Through the chair, Representative Keller, thank you for your question about my wife. She's doing amazingly well for the surgery that she had, and we're grateful for that. In terms of the cost of vaccines, they do continue to become more and more expensive, and we have more and more diseases that we can prevent with the vaccines. But 20 years or so ago, probably a couple hundred dollars for vaccines for a newborn through age two, about $1,700 now. And the costs do continue to go up, and that's a reality. I also understand and relate to what you say. I'm here now. I love the opportunity to have the job that I have. It's a real privilege, but I know someday it will be war too. And that we all want to make sure that we have protections there. So I would certainly, you know, welcome any constraints that would be necessary. Absolutely clear that if we had 2 million barrels a day flowing through the pipeline, wouldn't be a knee-jerk, okay, give us more money. Now, this legislature could decide, or the governor could decide what he want to ask for. But I think what we're talking right now, the reality is driven by the throughput, but even if it goes back up, it's not foreseen that we would ask for more. So if the prices go up, if the costs go up, if we got, say we got a new vaccine for another disease that came online next year and would drive the cost, but the savings would come to the payers, to the employers, to the insurance companies, and that they would be providing that anyway and having to pay at the higher cost. And this program makes it more easily available, easier for the providers. The providers won't be paying. Now, there will be providers like the tribal health system that may or may not decide to participate in this, and they can access the federal procurement schedules anyway. If they don't participate, then they won't be receiving the vaccine that Premera or others are buying for the folks that they're not participating with. So the payment would come from the payers. It will probably go up because vaccines do get more expensive. We get new vaccines, but the savings will still be there from what they would be having to pay otherwise with the individual provider buying one dose or 20 doses or whatever at a time, and the state being able to buy in bulk this way through the Federal Procurement Authority.
Okay. Follow-up?
Just a quick follow-up. It's a fantastic system that has been put together. I'm glad it's being tested in the states. We don't have to run out the prototype. And I think it's a valid question about the adults, and I just wanted to confirm again that would ultimately be the priorities on that will be set by the council, you know, children first, cost effective inoculations, etc., would all be first choices, and then you know, if there's money and evidence there, then maybe the newer ones. And I'm just testing my understanding by throwing this out there, and I invite you to correct me if you see a flaw.
Yes, through the chair, Representative Keller, upper limit would be all of the vaccines recommended by the American Committee on Immunization Practice for all citizens. Now, as you heard earlier, half or a little more of kids already get funded through the federal Vaccines for Children program. A quarter, a little more now currently have insurance that covers it, and that will go up a little bit. But we would want to try to get all the Alaskans who will accept vaccines immunized, with the top being the list recommended by ACIP and the whole population. But if there's not money, then the priorities would kick in.
Thank you.
Dr. Hilbert, calling around to a couple of the tribal entities, I was told today, and once again, this information may be inaccurate, but still, you know, what you get over the telephone, we have to still do more research on it. But talking with them, they said that they get their vaccines from the state and that it doesn't come out of IHS money. But I'm not going to say that's confirmed or not, but that was, and I kind of suspected that anyways. Is that true? Is that what you know of?
Mr. Chairman, the Vaccines for Children program that Jill described earlier does cover all Alaska Native kids and other American Indian kids that may be in our state, as well as any on Medicaid, and they do access that supply there. Okay. They are able to buy through, as a tribal entity, as kind of standing in lieu of the federal government and the legal interpretation, and I shouldn't go beyond that because I'm not a lawyer, but they are able to buy through the federal authority. So, for example, Dr. Joe Klaika, who's the medical director for YKHC, said that YK spends about $500,000 a year
their money buying vaccines where they may have, say, a non-native person in Bethel who comes in, and that's their source of medical care. And one of the advantages of the self-determination program where the tribes took it over from the federal government, it's much easier for them to be a community resource where there's no private sector there. So they will buy vaccines for them there, and then they do spend, the figures that he gave me was about $500,000 a year.
Well, and the only reason I brought that up was because of the assessment value, because we know that the federal portion of this bill, they're not part of the assessment value because they don't put into that. And so if IHS money can't be put into the assessment, then, you know, the other insurance companies are going to have to, you know, front that portion out for that, which is, you know, I thought was interesting how we look at it. Of course, we're working on that problem, too. The other question I've got, and maybe you can help clear this up, is reading the bill, and I may not have read it right, but a covered individual means an adult or child who resides in the state and who's provided insurance coverage for recommended vaccine by an accessible entity or who is a patient of another program participant. Now, what I'm trying to get at is that the bill only covers adults that have coverage. Is that, am I not reading that correctly?
Mr. Chairman, I probably shouldn't comment too much on the language, but the intent has been that it would cover everybody. The assessment would provide the pool of money that comes out as a portion of the saving that the payers get, the insurance companies, the ERISA plans, go for the uninsured where there's not coverage, or today there's some underinsured individuals, but if they have insurance coverage, then that insurance coverage, the assessment would go to pay for that. For example, where I have coverage through Alaska Care, and you have coverage there, and Alaska Care through the TPA would do it. Department of Administration expressed some concern. Well, we want to make sure that we don't get, if we participate, that we don't get double billed on this, and there's language there to assure that that doesn't happen. If Aetna, as the TPA, pays it, that would be the payment for folks in Alaska Care. Does that respond to your question?
You did. Thank you. And we'll get a little more clarification on that, too, as we go through the process. Are there any other questions? No other questions. Thank you for your testimony. We appreciate it, and we'll probably be hearing back from you again. Do we have Patricia Center? Alaska Nurses Association?
Yes. Mr. Chairman, my name is Patricia Center. I'm a family nurse practitioner, and I am professional practice director for the Alaska Nurses Association. I'm speaking today in favor of Senate Bill 169. I, for many years, ran a clinic that served homeless teenagers. As part of our service at that clinic, we provided immunizations to youth up through age 21. And in addition, provided immunizations such as Tdap vaccine and flu vaccine for our staff. In order to provide this service, we had to invest in a $2,000 refrigerator with alarms to make sure the immunizations were kept at a proper temperature. Prior to the loss of universal coverage, we had one set of vaccines for our 18 and under youth. We also had state-provided Tdap for adults. Since that loss, we've had to keep two sets of vaccines, one for those eligible for state vaccine program and one for everyone else. This requires a lot of extra record keeping and expense. Those vaccines we keep for those who are not eligible for the state program, we have to buy at rates on the market. What I pay for vaccines is considerably more than what the government expense would be. I want to remind you that adults or anyone over age 18, many of these people are young parents with young children, and there is a move to vaccinate these parents against flu and whooping cough so they don't transmit these diseases to their children who are too young to be vaccinated. With the current program, we have to buy vaccines, and by the way, you can't just buy a single vial of vaccine, a single dose of vaccine. They come in packages of 10. Sometimes you don't need packages of 10, and you have to buy them in that quantity. Then if you don't use them all, you have ones that are wasted, and so you lose the money you invested in those wasted vaccines. after you've purchased these vaccines, then you can apply for reimbursement as you use them and give them to patients. The price we and other private providers pay for vaccines is much more than the government or large providers pay for their vaccines. Being able to obtain vaccines through the state, as we did in the past, would be a great savings to us as providers. And I might add that everyone is used to using the vaccine depot that the state runs, and we already have applications in with the vaccine depot. So that said, providers are already familiar with that program and the program is familiar with providers. I might add that one day I came into work and the staff said we took in a new young person and they've been crippled with polio. And I said, this can't be. We haven't had a case of polio in the United States since the 1980s. And they said, well, this young woman came to us from Romania. It just makes us aware that how quickly what's going on in other parts of the world and how quickly diseases can be transmitted to even places like Alaska. This bill will greatly reduce the amount insurance companies have to reimburse us as providers for immunizations, and that's where the savings come. Well, we hope that you will approve this program and allow it to go forward.
Any questions? No. All right, thank you. Jodine? Is it Buto?
Yes, this is Dr. Buto. Hi, my name is Jody Buto. I'm a pediatrician. I'm past president of the American Academy of Pediatrics, and I'm a private practice pediatrician here in Anchorage. And thank you for allowing me to support this very important piece of legislation. For disclosure, I am actually on the association committee as one of the private providers in helping to try to develop a program. I can only echo what Dr. Hilbert and the nurse practitioner, I'm sorry, I didn't hear her name, so eloquently said. And my colleagues, we talked about this today at our department meeting. The whole gist of trying to get our kids, one, identified as needing immunizations, and then trying to work through the logistics of two refrigerators or our refrigerator actually has a big dividing line down the middle of it, and but our staff has to spend a lot of time trying to make sure that they get it from the right box and document it in the right column. And so having a universal system, it just makes that much more easily done. I'm more than happy to be available for questions that someone might have had at this point.
Right. Seeing no questions, thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
Well, let's go to the audience. We have a, is it Pavi Richards? Am I saying that? Paul? Your Y looks like an I. Sorry.
Sometimes I have that problem.
Go ahead.
Chairman Higgins, Vice Chair Keller, and members of the committee. My name is Paul Richards, and I represent PHRMA, the acronym for Pharmaceutical Research and Manufacturing Association. Their members are made up of all the manufacturers of all kinds of medicines prescriptions in the United States. And I'm not here to speak to the bill directly. I'm here to introduce a representative by PHRMA who has come here to discuss the bill, talk about it in detail, and answer any questions that have concerned. His name is Kurt Stembridge. He's from GlaxoSmithKline, and he'll answer any questions and talk the bill in detail. Thank you.
Go ahead and put your name on the record for us.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Kurt Stembridge. I am here representing PHRMA. GlaxoSmithKline is a pharma company, and they've asked me to come and testify for them. I am the task force chair for pharma in Idaho, and because of that, I will be leaning on a lot of the learnings that Idaho has done over the last 4 years on doing one of these assessment programs. Idaho has an assessment program. It started in 2010, but it is only a pediatric only. Pharma recommends three amendments to Senate Bill 169. And if you have the bill in front of you, I'll go through those and I'll talk to the proposed amendments. On page 5, line 27, under covered individuals, we would recommend that it strike the words an adult. This would make this program a pediatric only program, just like the other 9 states that are out there, like Idaho. The second, I'll talk to the bill first and then I'll talk to our reasoning. The second suggestion for the amendment to 169 is on the section 1809, page 2, 1809-210, the assessment council. We would recommend that a member of the House and a member of the Senate be added to that committee. And I'll talk to that one. And then thirdly, on that same count, that same section, two health on line 28, two health care providers, designate one of those health care providers as a pediatrician. Mr. Chairman, let me just talk about the first part of making this a pediatric-only immunization program. Idaho has run this for the last 4 years, and they have had their struggles, basically because of ERISA plans. ERISA plans are governed by federal control, not by states, and because of that, they have the option to either pay in or pay out. One of the biggest ERISA plans is TRICARE. TRICARE, over the last 4 years in Idaho, has not paid in whatsoever. They have decided not to pay in, and because of that, the state of Idaho has to keep their program solvent, and so you're not just taking my word for me, here is the bill for the state of Idaho this year. And on the fourth paragraph down, it says $546,000 along with intent language to cover the cost of TRICARE vaccinations. So to keep their program solvent, they have to dump state money. Well, you all are in a very fortunate position. Because of the good work from Senator Giesel and others with House Bill 310, you have $4.6 million sitting out there that can get this pediatric program up and running. And if these ERISA plans do not pay into the assessment, you've got some time to work through that problem. Now, the problem with the adults is that you will compound the problem with ERISA plans. If TRICARE Pediatric is not paying in, TRICARE Adult will not pay in also. And then again, if the big behemoth out there, Medicare, decides not to pay into this assessment, this lead time you've created with House Bill 310 now is going to get scrunched pretty quickly. But right now, we're making this a pediatric-only immunization program, you will have time to get it up and running. The second problem with the adult program is there's only one out there trying to get it done. There's not a model that says this is exactly how you do it. And the third thing that really upsets us as manufacturers is there's a vibrant, growing adult market out there right now where people, because of the ACA, the Affordable Care Act, requires that all insurance companies cover preventative services. We don't need to limit them because the ACA makes them a requirement for all people. So lo and behold, the adult portion only covers people with insurance. So, and then also in this bill, it says it's voluntary. I would say, probably argue that it's not voluntary. Let me give you an example. If you have two pharmacies out there that are competing across the street from each other, the first pharmacy says, yeah, I'm going to step up. I'm going to take this state dollars so I don't have to buy the vaccine. And the second one says, no, I believe in the free market system. I'm going to go back on the open market and buy this. Well, two individuals with the exact same insurance walk through both doors. This one's going to get a shot, and then they're just going to bill the administration fee. Well, this one over here, because of the ACA, cannot be charged any out-of-pocket. He's going to get the shot, and then the pharmacist is going to submit for reimbursement and going to get denied. As soon as an insurance company pays into the assessment, they sever the reimbursement mechanism because they don't want to be billed twice. So lo and behold, this pharmacist that is pro-business, pro-competition, lo and behold, they only have two choices. either join the program or don't give immunizations whatsoever. And that is a problem. We want as many immunizations as possible out there. My iPad turned off. Sorry about that. The second amendment that we have for Senate Bill 169 of the Assessment Council, and why we recommend legislators be put on that council, is because these eight-member people on this council are not elected officials. You're giving eight people the ability to tax. You can call it an assessment, whatever you want, but it is the ability to tax, and they're not accountable to the voting public. That's why Idaho put two legislators on their board, so that they have some way in the legislature that's looking over this system. The third one, like I mentioned, a practicing pediatrician, they're experts in vaccines. They know this. They would provide great expertise. The final thing with this adult portion is you are subsidizing insurance companies off the back of pharmaceutical industry. We spend billions, and that's with a B, every year to invent medications and vaccines to prevent diseases. And under the ACA, the coverage of vaccines are built into those premiums. Nobody's going to sit out there and say, oh, we're going to guess next year. They're going to build all that in. And so I take great pride in working for a pharmaceutical company that is looking for the next cure, looking to prevent more vaccine-preventable diseases. Mr. Chairman, any questions? And where did my help go?
I kind of do have a question, and that's on the getting back to the insurer. Now, in Idaho, you guys have this assessment program.
Correct.
Correct. And so, but you're only participating in the pediatric side.
Correct.
So if a provider, like you're just saying, across the street from each other, I guess the scenario you gave is one is going into the state system, one is not.
And talking about adults.
Well, I know, but I'm trying to figure out, does the insurance companies, I understand what you're saying, they don't want to double bill. In other words,
correct.
Their system basically says we've already given money for vaccines, and so we're covered for our quarter or however we set it up. So anybody within the state, which what you're saying, that has that insurance and it goes to another provider, the insurance is going to deny it because they've said, hey, you should have went to the state.
Correct.
And I'm just wondering if they actually do that, or do they actually look at the provider and his number, and so when the provider sends in, you know, the code under the policy number, and basically, you know, will they not pay that?
Well, all I can refer back to is Idaho. When they instituted the pediatric portion, they turned off every vaccine reimbursement code in the state because these insurance companies said, we are already paid in. We're not going to be double billed. And so that would happen exactly the same thing for adults because they've already paid into the system. Why should they leave open this? It's a CPT code,
right,
to be reimbursed. So it does definitely sever that ability for that other pharmacist to get reimbursed.
I see you're making us do our homework here.
Okay. But in the end, can I just say one other thing? We want to provide as many vaccines as possible to the people of Alaska.
Right.
They save money. I mean, every time you give a vaccine, you're saving money, and it benefits the citizens of Alaska. We are definitely not anti-vaccine.
And I would agree with you. You know, I grew up in Alaska, and Alaska is a big state, and we're different than any other state in the union, and I'm proud of that. And one of the things that I think we work towards is basically taking care of our people, mm-hmm. adults and children. One of the things that I heard years ago, I'm a dentist, by the way, don't know it, was I would go out to the villages, and we took care of the pediatrics. And I heard the seniors and the elders would come to me and go, what about us? What about us? You guys always forget about us. And so we worked hard on doing an enhancement program for adults in the dentistry field of it. And I'm proud of that work. And so now we do that. So the point is we do want to cover our adults and we do want to cover our children. And so we're going to find a way to make that work if we can.
Right.
And that's what our role is here today is to try to see if we can't do that.
Can I add one other thing?
Sure.
One thing that this bill is not addressing is the patients that have no insurance. If you look on the fiscal note that was brought up earlier on fiscal note 7, if you turn to the notes section, the analyst section on, let's see, it's the fourth paragraph down that starts with this bill. This bill reconstructs how vaccines are purchased and distributed. It would provide state distributive vaccine to all children and adults who are covered by an assessed payer, and then in parentheses, all except insured, uninsured adults whom there is no payer. This doesn't help those people at all. I would rather we put our time, our effort, our money into going after people that have no insurance than trying to subsidize the insurance industry.
Great. I would agree. Representative Reinbold.
Okay, this is a little bit of a comment, but there's a couple of questions in here. But basically, as you know, healthcare is going under fundamental transformation right now, which is very confusing to many of us. You, at one point, you said in your testimony something about insurance on the backs of something, but I didn't quite understand what you were saying. If there was two pockets and they can't get reimbursed because one buys from here and one buys from here, do you recall saying something having to do that? I don't know who's writing on the back of who and who's not going to be reimbursed, or if you could clarify that, and then I'll finish my comment.
Okay. Well, what I was saying is that because of insurance companies already paying into the assessment, they will turn off the reimbursement mechanism. So the one that the private, we want to be competition, buy on the open market, they have no payer because they can't submit for reimbursement to that insurance company because they've already paid into the assessment. The other one is just accessing state-supplied vaccine.
Okay, can I finish?
Yeah, follow up.
Mr. Chairman. Okay, so basically, I don't know what the future holds. I don't know about superbugs. I just know that a lot of us know that the pharmaceutical industry, as well as the providers, as well as insurance companies, all play an important role. And I'm trying to figure out in this bill, I haven't had the opportunity yet to talk to the sponsor about this, but I'm trying to, or even Hess, the commissioner, so I still would like the opportunity to do that. I did ask a question to Dr. Hurlburg, but basically I'm trying to figure out who are the potential winners and losers. Is the state, the feds, you know, the TRICARE, the people, the kids, the providers? I mean, how is this changing? Is it increasing access? Is it decreasing costs? If so, who's it decreasing costs to, from your opinion?
Well, since if we go with the pharma amendment and turn this into a pediatric bill, if we don't, I should say, the big winners is going to be the insurance companies because they are the ones that are required by the ACA to cover all immunizations, not just some, all immunizations. So if you go out as a state and create this state-run program and bring them all together, they're going to love it because they are going to receive the benefit. The pediatric side, and let me just say, the pediatricians have a tough job. I mean, under the current system, this would help them out immensely, and that's why we want to make it a pediatric bill. But this adult, all it is a subsidy to the insurance companies.
Representative Keller.
On that point, just trying to understand. It goes along with your comment of the, you know, farmer riding on the back, you know, or you carrying it on your back. Just the question is, but you control the prices, right? Doesn't the drug industry, you can set the price at whatever you want. So if enough states get on the bandwagon here and collect on the good price on pharmacy wholesale, which is a very natural thing for us to do, then don't you control the price?
Well, Mr. Chairman, and Representative Keller, we all set our own prices, but it's competition. Example right now, we have multiple pharmaceutical companies out taking orders for flu for next year. That is a very competitive private market, which would totally go away under this program. The other thing is this contract that everybody talks about. This contract was negotiated with CDC for a very specific clientele. It is people that have no insurance, insurance that isn't covered, and for people with CHIP and Native Alaskans. That's what that contract was negotiated. And as more and more states fall on top of that, we're going to have problems because that's not what this contract was designed to do, was to let insurance companies basically take advantage of this federal contract. So that's the other big if. What happens if CDC comes back and tells the state of Alaska, no, you can't access that? Now they've got to go out and run and find some other contract, a Minnesota multi-state contract or something like that, that will to buy off of that contract. So, you know, we always hear about this CDC contract, but it was designed umpteen years ago for just that population, not to subsidize insurance companies.
Okay. Any other questions? Nope. Thank you. We appreciate your testimony. And just so that people are aware that we're running a little bit out of time here, we have, I think, one more in the audience, and you'll have to
Denise Costello.
I'm having a hard time reading today.
No, it's her handwriting, Mr. Chair, is a little bit to be desired, and I happen to know her. So I can tease her a little bit.
So, Denise, if you... keep aware of our time limit here.
I'll be very brief.
Thank you.
So my name for the record is Denise Daniello, and I'm the executive director for the Alaska Commission on Aging, which is a commission, a governor-appointed commission that plans services for seniors, educates Alaskans about senior issues, and advocates for the needs of all older Alaskans. Here today on behalf of the commission to testify in support of SB 169. Our commission was very much involved in Senator Giesel's legislation a couple of years ago to provide a program to insure people who are underinsured and uninsured so that they would have access to vaccines. So we're building on the support that we provided earlier for that bill. You know, I think we all can agree that immunizations are important for the health of everybody across the lifespan. And for seniors, their immune systems weaken with age, so it's really important they have access to vaccines. And the ones that are recommended by the U.S. Preventative Task Force and Centers for Disease Control include influenza and the pneumonia vaccines. For people age 65 and older, and the shingles vaccine for people age 60 years and older. So there is some underutilization of these vaccines by seniors. There's only, I believe, 11% of seniors who make use of the shingles vaccine. And part of the reason that may be is because some of these seniors are low income. They can't afford the copays, the deductibles, even those who are covered by Medicare. Sometimes their providers don't accept Medicare payment. So we believe that access to this program would allow seniors to have improved access to the vaccines. For people who are age 60 to 64, they are not covered by Medicare. And so that wouldn't help them. So they need to have access, improved access to these vaccines. And we also see, thirdly, that this program would help grandparents who are raising grandchildren who live on a fixed income. Many times, kids, of course, need their shots in order to get into school. And sometimes grandparents don't have the funding in order to do it, and Medicare does not cover the cost of their grandchildren's immunizations, of course. So this program would also serve them as well. So we are in support of SB 169.
Any questions? Nope. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
And what we're going to do now is we're going to hold this bill over for another hearing. We've gone through all the public testimony, but we're going to keep public testimony open for another round, and we appreciate the sponsor for bringing this bill forward. So we'll move on to our other bill. So we'll take a brief at ease. Let's see here. We have, under previously heard bills, HB 319. May I have a motion to bring CS HB 319 before the committee?
Mr. Chair, I move CS HB 319 28 LS 0199, and is it version Papa? Is that the one that is coming before us now?
Yeah.
A new one? Okay, for discussion. Thank you.
Yep. Hearing no objections, HB 319 version Papa is before the committee. Come on up, Representative.
you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Representative Tammy Wilson, District 2. This bill was before you before, and I just want to go through just what the two sections do. It does have some more work that needs to be done on it, but there was some statements that were made at the last hearing that I kind of want to make sure that everybody's clear about what the bill does. So the first part of the bill requires wholesalers to be licensed like our in-state wholesalers. So if you do not want to license the out-of-state companies, then we shouldn't do the ones on the in-state. And we're talking about approximately at least 400 companies from out-of-state that currently has business done in Alaska that are not regulated or licensed in the same fashion as those who are in-state. So the first part of the bill really is just about making things fair. So whether or not the committee would like to bring in the out-of-state and put them on the same page as the in-state by having the pharmacy board regulate and have them licensed through there, that's one option. Or the other option would be to say, well, we don't want to do out-of-state wholesalers, so we shouldn't regulate the in-state. So right now we just don't have, we have some unfairness going on here. So the second part is continuing a practice that's been going on for many years. We have allowed compound prescriptions for many years, and the retirees were told that the new administrator would continue the same services as the past provider. Now the department administration says they need to take, they need time to study this issue. At the last meeting, Deputy Commissioner Barnhill said compounding prescriptions could have negative effects, although there have been no reported cases in the state. The physicians are the ones prescribing the medically necessary compounding prescription, not the pharmacist. This is about big business running our local pharmacies out of business. Aetna has partnered with CVS, which will benefit if the state discontinues the practice of compounding. What kind of message does that send our retirees who no longer will be able to get the medication they need? If this is the message the committee wants to send to our retirees and small businesses, then you need to set this bill aside. It really is to that point. We had 50, we heard that there was 55,000 calls made when we changed to a new provider, and it was told to our retirees it would be the same. As we did more investigation, we came down and found out a lot of it was compounding. And just to review what that is, it is when you go to your local pharmacy and for whatever reason, maybe an allergy, maybe extra medication that you don't need in a certain pill, and it's put, basically a recipe is put together and that pill is made for you. Or sometimes it's through a chewable, it depends upon what it is. But I was pretty upset last time when we had someone come up here and blame pharmacists for giving something out that might not be good for someone. They don't have that option. A prescription comes from a physician, and it should be up to the physician to tell their patient what is good and what is bad, and side effects. And the pharmacist does the same thing, but to put that on the back of the pharmacist I thought was really upsetting. So we have been working with the department administration. Before we came here, we did finally get a statement from the commissioner after many, many tries from your office, Mr. Chair, as well as mine. And so I really wanted to put this on the record so that I still don't think they need the study that they've had, because we have been doing it for years and years. I truly believe, and this is just one representative with this belief, is that somebody did not read very well when they gave this contract to Aetna, realizing that compounding was not in it. But I want to make sure that if this isn't continued, it is our retirees are the ones who are not able to get the medication. So this came from, and I will make sure that you have this copy when I leave. I'm sorry I didn't make enough copies. But this came from Commissioner Thayer. It says, you have my word. We will make a final decision after we discuss with the legislature and better understand the pros and cons from medical professionals. We have committed to allow compounding the remainder, it says reminder, but I know it means remainder, of the year and into next year. There is a lot to learn on the subject. Although I am somewhat pleased that he's kind of come around to allowing this, I just don't want to leave the committee with the understanding that there's been problems, you know, in the state of Alaska. Compounding's been done for years and years and years. And really, with our small pharmacies here, as more people have been able to order 2 and 3 months worth of prescriptions and send those out of state, they lost that business because it was cheaper to be able to do that. So what do? They pivoted to a specialty, and that's what compounding is. And now, in my opinion, again, one representative, we have a major company out of state that would benefit if we weren't going to continue this. So we're going to stay on top of it. The bill in front of you that you've seen may open up the compounding issue much wider than we think, but as you heard last time, Deputy Commissioner said that we didn't get the last bill right, so we wanted to make sure that the state insurance plan, and that's the one we were talking about, and of course they're backed up with the federal government being self-insured, that we do give our retirees what we told them we would, and that we would keep that promise. So with that, Mr. Chair, I just wanted to make sure that everybody knew where I stood.
Thank you. And I appreciate those comments, too, and I also echo your comments on our compounders in the state. They're very good at what they do. I've used them several times, and they do know what they're doing, and that's why they went to school to do that. So I appreciate that. And I also appreciate the fact that the administration and Aetna are both working together on trying to solve this issue. And like you, I also believe it's just a bureaucracy issue and an oversight, which hopefully will get fixed. So.
And I appreciate that, Mr. Chair, and I just want to make sure that, you know, this wasn't something that made it appear that our pharmacists were doing anything incorrect, because that is not true.
That is. I agree. Well,
I guess.
Representative
Raymond. Okay. I just have a question for your testimony. The 400, you said 400, are they medical device or is that compounding, strictly compounding?
Representative Reinbold, through the chair, those are the ones who are putting medical devices into our state without having any oversight. Has nothing to do with compounding at all.
Okay. So that's exactly what I just wanted to make sure that we were clarifying. The 400, did you say wholesalers or companies?
Wholesale companies who sell devices. Representative Reinbold, through the chair.
Okay. Right.
Did you have follow-up? No?
No.
Okay. Representative Keller.
Yeah. Thank you, and thank you for bringing this bill forward. I just want to understand your first comments on the first section. I think you said that the purpose was to make sure that both the in-state and the out-of-state were treated the same. But did you address the question that I believe came up that the new licensure for device distributors is being introduced here, possibly? As I understand it, it takes a script to distribute a drug. It doesn't take a script to sell, you know, on the market a lot of devices. So it seems to me like what you may be doing, maybe intentionally or not intentionally, I don't know, I just want to understand, is that you're saying that if it's a medical device, they need to be licensed in state, which is not currently being done, right? The word device.
Correct. Devices that, if you're an in-state provider, you're being licensed through the Board of Pharmacy. If it's an out-of-state company bringing the same device into the state of Alaska, they are not licensed.
Through the chair.
Follow up?
I will look at the language. I did not read it before. It seems to me like you've added the word device to drugs. It seems like that expands the scope of the licensure, and that's what I'm trying to figure out. But I don't have to answer that now.
We will get that to you, Representative Keller. Thank you.
And so that the committee understands, me and the representative have had conversations on this bill, and basically, and we'll have a little more conversation on it. But the intent is to hold this bill over, and not to move it. So we will just. And if we decide to move it, we'll bring it back before the committee. All right. So we're still working on it. So follow up.
I'm sorry. I just want to get it on record that I have concerns about the device, medical device. I don't know what the unintended consequences will be if it's not licensed. I don't know if it's punitive damage. I don't know the effects. So I would like to have the opportunity to discuss this further. In regards to, I don't know if it's a pacemaker and it's not licensed here, is the doctor going to have punitive damages if he ends up using that pacemaker, just for an example? But there's literally thousands and thousands of things, you know, that could be considered medical devices. So I just want to bring that up, but I know that will be vetted.
And Richard Runville, through the chair, we are not licensing the actual device. It is the companies. And what you've just brought up is exactly why the pharmacist brought it up, is because right now we have all sorts of devices coming into the state completely unregulated. And so we actually could be bringing things that are detrimental to people because they don't go through the same process. And like I said, I have no problem with one way or the other. I just think that if we're going to do one thing to those who have chosen to be in the state of Alaska and we're putting them through a different process than those who've chosen to have their businesses somewhere else, I just think we need to make it fair. And so the discussions can go on later on which way is the preference of this committee.
Okay. Follow-up?
A follow-up. I think it's important. I don't know if the Board of Pharmacy can make a decision whether, you know, that wholesale, you know, it is registered or not. I just want to know what the unintended consequences were if this wholesaler were not. But I do think it's a very, very important. And what other states are doing? Are all the other states requiring that a wholesaler has to register in their state?
Mr. Reinbold, through the chair. You know, honestly, I don't care what other states are doing. And the reason I don't care is because I don't think we should take our small businesses and our residents and require them to do things that we're not requiring people from out of state to do. So you have both selling the same thing under different regulations, under different rules. And all I'm saying is that if we want, for some reason, we decided we wanted that for our in-state providers, why we would allow out-of-state providers to be able to come under the radar, not be underneath the same regulations, not pay the same fees, and put our own in-state providers at a fiscal disadvantage is completely beyond me. And can they be with the Board of Pharmacy? Can they be licensed to them? Absolutely, because that's what our people already have to do. So, you know, to me, this is completely about fairness. Why would you put one group through hoops and make them go and pay extra fees and another one out of state who's not even invested in your state and give them better rules, better economics than our own? That is completely insane.
I would just definitely like to get testimony through the chair from others that are actually the providers.
Yeah. That's fine. You can treat them separate, whatever you want.
And I was told that originally they closed public testimony on this bill, but I am going to open it up again. I'm going to keep testimony open on the bill in case we bring it back before the committee. But we do have a Richard Holm on the line. Richard, are you on?
I am.
And Richard, if you have anything else to say, because there's a big question mark by your name, like whether or not you want to say anything or not, but we're kind of out of time a little bit, but I'll give you a couple minutes if you'd like.
Thank you. I might be able to shed a little bit of light on the question that's in front of the committee right now. My name is Richard Holm, or Dick Holm. I am I'm a pharmacist in North Pole. I'm calling from North Pole now. I am the immediate past chair of the Board of Pharmacy, so I've had a lot to do with this bill or the building of it. The question is, there seems to be worry about devices and whether they would be available or not, that brought up pacemaker and what have you, but I'm going to speak as a member of the Board of Pharmacy, even though I am off of it as of this month. But the board is interested in regulating the out-of-state wholesalers, many of which not only carry the drugs, but they carry drugs, they carry chemicals, which would be used in compounding. They also carry devices. Devices can be many different things. The board wants or needs the ability to regulate these wholesalers. We're not regulating the devices. There are usually many opportunities from different wholesalers to get the same device. We're simply regulating it, and it seems strange that if a company is selling drugs and they're also selling devices, why would we regulate one side of their business and not the other? The other is we see it as protection of our citizens in Alaska and giving them the ability to go to a body or board and register a complaint if for some reason they have a complaint, and know that there's some place or know that there's a board that will go and investigate their complaint. it may not go any further, but at least they know it's being investigated. Right now, these wholesalers out of state are sending into our state, and they are not regulated, so they answer to no one. And in some cases, they are sending in devices and drugs to individuals who are not licensed in our state to handle those drugs or devices. And there's no repercussion to them for doing such. They answer to no one. So I hope that maybe clears up some of that those questions.
It does.
Available to answer anything else that you might have.
Any questions? Nope. All right. Thank you. And we will hold this bill over, and we'll take a brief at ease while we set up for our next bill. Thank you. We have before us, may I have a motion to bring CSHB 319 before the committee, right?
No.
Or are we going to the other one?
Yeah.
Sorry.
352 Page.
Chairman Page. Here we go. Sorry. May I have a motion to bring HB 355 before the committee?
355. Chair Higgins, I move HB 355 version 5021 alpha before the committee for discussion.
Hearing no objections, HB 355 version A is before the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and members of the committee.
Actually, I should actually say your name. They can't register my hand.
Yes. So. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Garen Tarr, State Representative for House District 17 in Anchorage. Thank you for the opportunity to bring this bill forward. This is a topic that's come before our committee before, and I know something that's of importance to all Alaskans, and this is the issue of mental health and what's happening in our state. What draws my attention to this issue is our high suicide rates. We have, you know, much higher than the national average, an average of 136 suicides a year in Alaska. And what's interesting to me about that is that research shows 90% of suicide victims have a diagnosable, treatable mental or substance abuse disorder. So in looking at how we might address these high rates of of mental illness and some of these disorders that are leading to our high rates of suicide, I learned more about mental health first aid. And mental health first aid is similar to the concept of traditional first aid. And if you think about being in a restaurant or a public location and encountering someone who was choking or had injured themselves, you know, with a cut or had some, you know, pain in their chest, most people would have some idea of how to respond in that immediate first moment or few minutes before trying to get, you know, emergency care for that individual. And so what mental health first aid takes that same model, but wants to give someone the tools to respond in that immediate first few moments of a mental or emotional crisis. And mental health first aid, it was developed in Australia. It's been taken around the state. We did a lunch and learn earlier this session that was well attended, and then just last week did an actual mental health first aid training, which is the 8-hour course that allows you to become certified in mental health first aid. And so in looking at what kind of policy alternatives can be used to implement these programs, came across legislation in a couple of other states and looked into introducing that legislation here. So what you have before you today is the bill that has come out of that effort. And in this particular bill, what we're proposing is mental health first aid for youth as a way to start. And so it directs the department to do this for persons who are less than 18 years old. And focusing in on that youth population, we know that's where the highest rates of suicide are. Alaska Native men between the ages of 15 to 24 have the highest rates of suicide among all demographics in the United States. So want to try and catch these young Alaskans at their most vulnerable time. There is some good work happening in the state with mental health first aid training, and a couple of people that are here I think could speak to that. So I know we're very time limited, and if it would be okay now, I'll close my comments with that brief introduction so that we might be able to hear from these experts before they're not available.
Thank you. And why don't you come forward, your experts. So we'll open public testimony at this time on HB 355, and go ahead and put your name on the record and your affiliation.
My name is Jill Ramsey. I'm with the University of Alaska, the Center for Human Development in the College of Health. And I am the training coordinator there for mental health first aid and a number of other trainings. So thank you, Chair and representatives, for the opportunity to speak about mental health first aid. So for the last 2.5 years, we've been coordinating this training through the Trust Training Cooperative, and responding to so many different populations who are requesting this training. So it's a very broad sort of need that we're trying to meet. I take probably, 12 to 15 phone calls a day, or have messages for me from teachers, bus drivers, librarians, police officers, clergy. I mean, so a wide group of people who are seeking this training. So really anyone who has interaction with the public is looking for ways to deal with some common mental health problems before they become full-blown crises. And this has been the aim of the program all along. The other states, there's 22 states and municipalities who have appropriated money for mental health first aid because of suicide rates, because of really a focus on prevention and early intervention with mental health and substance use problems, long before the need for suicide prevention. So among those states, many have really embraced this as prevention, have tried to put it on par with standard first aid in the same sorts of ways. They're tracking this training, tracking the fidelity of the training, the outcomes of the training that are showing an improved literacy about mental health issues. People are able to talk about really difficult things that we haven't been able to talk about with each other. In doing that, we are breaking down some of those barriers for people to get help. It's less of an issue what the neighbors think if we can really sort of have these conversations. This week, the state of Colorado appropriated $750,000 just to expand their mental health first aid program, because in their 5 years of a pilot with it, have seen such a dramatic change in the number of 911 calls, visits to emergency rooms, all of these sorts of cost savings effects. So there have been life saving effects, and there have been cost saving effects that are really getting attention nationally. Texas just appropriated $5 million for their mental health first aid programs because of that. And, they're such a small state. I mean, we should really be paying attention to that.
I do have a question, though. What is the difference between, what do you call yourself again? Because what I'm trying to get at is you have behavioral health analysts, and they kind of do the same thing, don't they?
Well, no, because you become a nationally certified mental health first aid trainer, as you would have to become a certified standard first aid trainer. There's a training for that. There's a qualification for that.
I'm just trying to look at both of them and trying to figure out what's the difference between a behavioral health analyst and you and a mental health aid.
Well, a behavioral health analyst may or may not be a mental health first aid trainer.
But maybe you guys do the exact same thing.
It's a specific course that's taught. It's a certification.
Have you looked at the behavioral health analyst training?
No, I haven't.
Just out of curiosity. I mean, I haven't looked at your course either, and you're right. It could be apples and oranges here. Mm-hmm. But I'm just assuming that everyone does the same thing, but maybe not.
No. This is not a clinical training. This is a public education course for anyone, which is why I get calls from everyone for it. I think the most heartbreaking thing is when we have people who want to take the course because they've lost someone and they want to know what they should have done. Or, I get a lot of calls from high schools, get a lot of calls from college campuses. You know, how do we detect things? How do we steer people into treatment? How do we recognize when there's a need for that before there's some sort of presentation of a threat to harm self or others? You know, can we get there before that?
Representative Keller.
Yeah, thanks. really an innovative model. I compliment you. I guess it's a national model, but you know, it's really neat. Ian, regular Red Cross is driven by employers. I was wondering if you have done anything to get to, have you approached employers? I would think that if it's a good training program, that you know, it could be driven from that angle instead of general fund, you know, state, you know, as a possibility. I was curious if you looked into that at all.
Sure. Well, we get calls from everywhere, obviously, but we have looked at that. We have had a number of employers, large employers like BP, who are starting to look at it. Nationally, that's happening. Mental health first aid in Alaska is brand new. Okay. You know, we really, and the Trust Training Cooperative traditionally has been engaged in workforce development in the healthcare field. So we have been targeting direct service providers all of this time with our trainings. This is new for us, to branch out to do a community-wide, you know, public education course. We know, we're learning from other states. Other states have made it requirements for their public employees. There are many, many employers that are starting to require it alongside standard first aid. So everywhere that standard first aid is offered or required, mental health first aid has come with it without separation.
Representative Arnold?
Thank you, Jurgens. Basically, what my question is more of curiosity. I actually have two questions. But when you said males between 15 and 24 are the most likely to commit suicide, is that correct? Was that you? Okay. So basically what my question is, do you know what the driver in many of those cases is? It medical or chemical issues? Is it breakup issues? Is it parent disputes? Is it drugs, alcohol, bullying, grades or disappointment in school, car accidents, you know, just getting themselves into trouble in general? I mean, I'm just trying to find out what you want to try to go for the biggest target and have an intervention in those areas. And this is more out of my curiosity, just because I do work with teens sometimes. So it's just out of curiosity. Do you know what some of the biggest drivers are?
Through the chair, we have actually an expert in suicide prevention in the room that's going to testify.
Oh, okay.
Also, and she could speak to that probably better than I. We do know that a large percentage of people who complete suicide do have a diagnosable mental health issue and or substance use issue. When we've seen the combination of someone who feels isolated, disenfranchised maybe from their culture, maybe from their community, for whatever reason, and the addition of depression or substance use and lethal means, mm-hmm. Is a dangerous situation. That's statistically what's happened across the state.
Okay.
Sure. Good. And just out of curiosity, too, because this is the first time I'm hearing about this, what is your educational background? I mean, again.
Chair, I have a master's degree in psychiatric rehabilitation and a bachelor's degree in social work and psychology.
And so when did you, you know, get into this, you know, mental health first aid? I mean, when was you trained? At what point in your career did this pop up on your radar and you go, oh, I want to do this?
About 2.5 years ago when I was hired to be a training coordinator for the Trust Training Cooperative, and the advisory council made up of members from the provider community as well as the university asked us to take on mental health first aid. The Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority was very interested in ways to affect our community's literacy around mental health issues, break down stigma, and eventually that leads to better outcomes for trust beneficiaries.
And where did you get your training at?
For the
mental health.
Mental health first aid
yeah.
trainer. The National Council on Behavioral Health Care provides that training.
Well, did you have to go anywhere? Or
yes.
Was it, okay, where was that at?
My training happened to be in Seattle.
Oh, in Seattle. Okay, mm-hmm. All right. And then, because is this relatively new on the market, right, in the healthcare profession?
It is. It originated in Australia in 2001,
okay.
And it came to the U.S. in 2008. It came to Alaska 2011.
All right. Well, good. Representative Reibold.
It's hard to put a price on mental health. Okay, and I understand that, but I still think as overseers of the budget, is Mental Health Trust Authority partnering? Are they paying? You know, I know a lot of lands were granted to them. I'm just trying to find, as budgets dwindle, where we're going to find money to, you know, and like I said, it's just hard to put a value on life. It's priceless. So I understand that this is something that needs to be talked about. But I really would like that addressed.
Yes, Representative the Chair, the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority funded the initial startup. It was a small trust grant that sent the very first trainers to training from Alaska to become mental health first aid trainers. So they have been partners from the beginning. They also are part of our funding for the trust training cooperative comes from the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority, who is a very big supporter of mental health first aid. Now, since it is a public education course, I'm not sure that they feel they should be the sole funder of a public education course when they have really specific beneficiary needs and project areas. But they've been a very strong supporter.
Good.
Okay. No other questions. We'll bring up the other one.
And, Mr. Chairman, if I might, while Dave is coming up, if that'd be okay, if Representative Reinbold was bringing up the fiscal note, there are some things we'd like to address, and I think we'll run out of time today for that. But I think Dave might be able to address some of those things because as we reviewed it, we thought the cost could be reduced substantially in the first year by two-thirds and then in the ongoing year. So I'll just use that as an introduction for Dave, and maybe he can address that in his comments.
Dave, if you can put your name on the record and your affiliation.
My name is David Diamato. I'm the Senior Director of Health Policy for the Alaska Primary Care Association. So, you come back if they need me to. If there are more questions, because I knew you had one more bill you wanted to get through.
No.
Okay, great.
That's all right. Fine. We've ran out of time, so.
Okay.
You were
fair
right.
Enough. I just was trying to be accommodating. I know you guys have been accommodating to so many people today. So the Primary Care Association got involved with the mental health first aid in the middle of last year. What we did was we recognized that the work of mental health first aid was significant for our populations. The Alaska Primary Care Association is comprised of 160 community health centers scattered throughout the state of Alaska. And what we decided to do was we decided to fly trainers up from the National Council from Washington, where they were given trainings in the past, because what had happened for the state of Alaska in the past was that when they wanted to get trainers, they had to send trainers out to Seattle, for example, where Jill went. Our trainers, we decided what would be more effective would be to get a cohort of people trained that would be we could deploy into rural areas and throughout the state, rather than having mental health training simply in the state of Alaska or being part of a scheduled roadshow where a trainer would go to a particular community and then to another community. We thought by deploying them out into all our community health centers that our community health centers could begin the conversation of breaking down some of those barriers around mental health matters within their community. The importance of us getting trainers out there was manifold, but it was really down to one salient feature, was that getting trainers into those communities on mental health matters. Now, this bill is specific to children. We took the basic course. We took the primary mental health first aid trainer course and trained 30 trainers in that. So they'll be teachers in these communities. The most important reason we got those folks out there was their proximity and that they would be teachers in their communities. So part of the mental health first aid agenda through the National Council is to find people in the communities that are trusted, respected individuals, not necessarily trained specifically in particular behavioral health issues like, for example, Jill is, but teachers, clerics, folks who are respected within the community in different capacities, and to get them to start teaching people basic elements of mental health recognition and intervention, because it was the intervention piece that had been missing in so many ways in these rural communities. If you think about, and indulge me for a second, if you think about movies that you've seen that are period pieces that are 100 years ago, if you ever watch somebody drop and give somebody CPR in a Wild West movie, you know you're in the wrong movie. You know they didn't take care because it wasn't out there at that time. every one of us in this room these days thinks of first aid as sort of probably being something we're all familiar with, even if we've just seen it on TV. If we haven't taken the course, we know that we could render aid because we've seen it so much. It's been demystified. It's become a part of our life. We understand it. We're trying to do the same thing with mental health first aid, because mental health first aid, Alaska has got a serious mental health epidemic, and the APCA took that charge very seriously to start breaking down those barriers that are preventing true behavioral health and primary care integration. That's the part of the charge that the state of Alaska is going to be under for the next several years, to get the mind and body back together. And the APCA partnered with the Trust and partnered with the Trust Train Cooperative, and we all put in a significant amount of money to fly those trainers up, to train those people, and to deploy them out. We always knew, though, that this one particular training was not going to be enough for the state. There were children needs. The National Council is developing a specific training around veterans. They're developing a specific training around first responders, around rural issues, and around elder issues, because the elder issues are where so often behavioral health matters are misdiagnosed or misintervened incorrectly. So I know we're up against the time, and I'm happy to come back later and respond to any questions.
Thank you. Well, with that, I think we're going to hold this bill over, and we'll probably hear it again, and hopefully we'll have more time to discuss it. I think it's very interesting. First time I've heard about the mental health first aid training person. I think it's an important, maybe it's a good clog in the missing notch that we're looking for in our state. So very good. I appreciate you guys taking the time and having patience with us. So with that, we will keep public testimony open, and we will adjourn the meeting of the Health and Social Services until the time is 5:05 until next Tuesday, April 1st. Mm-hmm. And we are adjourned.